With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi there, and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. Today I want to talk a little bit about the relationship between Woodrow Wilson and later Franklin Roosevelt and the USSR. This is really interesting, and it shows that there is a kind of an evolving and quite complex and oftentimes quite confused relationship between these figures and what they perceive to be happening within Russia after the October Revolution. And a lot of what follows, a lot of the diplomacy and the, in some ways, quite cordial diplomacy from the White House towards the Soviet Union during the Paris Peace Conference and after, and then during the Great Depression, when Roosevelt is in office, is based on these assumptions, is based on beliefs that are fostered from within the administrations of these two Democrat presidents about what they think is happening in the USSR. So the first place to start, really, is with Woodrow Wilson. Woodrow Wilson was quite keen for the USSR to attend the Paris Peace Conference. But during 1919, the entirety of Russia is in chaos. It's very, very difficult to ascertain any kind of realistic picture of what's going on in Russia. Communications are very difficult. There is transport links have broken down. It's impossible for many people to get in and out of Russia, and such basic amenities as telegrams and a postal service in most of the country, because of the civil war, have collapsed. Actually, communicating with the new revolutionary government is very difficult. The attitude that Wilson has towards the new revolutionary government is quite ambiguous. He looked upon Tsarism as really an abomination. When Woodrow Wilson commits America to the war in April 1917, it comes 2 months after there has been what appears at face value to be a liberal democratic moment in Russia. Tsarism has fallen, and a provisional government has been put in situ, which is going to be a caretaker government until there can be elections for constituent assembly. So this all seems quite positive. And it helps people like Wilson and Lloyd George to rebrand the entire war effort as now a struggle of democracies against despotisms. Not that really the Kaiser's Germany and the Austro-Hungarian Empire were despotisms anything like, or anything on the scale of Tsarist Russia. But this convenient story, now that the Tsar has gone, can be told. And both Woodrow Wilson and Lloyd George have little sympathy for the Tsar and little sympathy for the ruling classes of Russia, and believe really that they kind of got what they deserved. The anti-communist in chief after October 1917 is, of course, Winston Churchill, who is perhaps one of the few figures that seems to really understand what the West faces with the Bolsheviks. The Bolsheviks are this small and very obscurist radical sect, if you will, that is very poorly understood in both the Western world and also in Russia itself. You know, not many people have heard of Lenin. Lenin, when he bumps into members of the public in the streets of Moscow after he's been he's seized power, there are people that have no idea who he is. This is the kind of the shaky foundations that government is on from 1918 up until really the end of the Civil War. The excesses, the murderous excesses of the Bolsheviks and the horrors of the Civil War are transmitted to the West by the various writers and journalists who stay on and during the Civil War, people such as John Reed and Arthur Ransom and other figures. A lot of it isn't believed. Much of what they're writing saying now is demonstrably true, that this was a horrifically bloody conflict where atrocities happened on all sides, and the Bolsheviks were very often given the benefit of the doubt by people like Wilson and people like Lloyd George, who preferred to think that, and whilst neither of these men were communists in any way, shape or form, and we mustn't ever go down that route, they rather hoped that what they saw emerging was a period of terror that would be followed by some kind of moderation, some kind of readjustment, some kind of end to the radicalism, and some kind of development of a, hopefully at some point in the future, a liberal republic. Now, this sounds hopelessly naive, and it sounds that these people were have been taken for a ride by the Bolsheviks. They were kind of the, you know, useful idiots, as Lenin would later describe the fellow traveller movement. And you can, by the way, you can check out the podcast I did on the fellow travellers. It's about, I think, about number 40 or 50 or something like that, but it's well worth a listen, if I dare say so myself. But we shouldn't be too hard on Wilson, and we shouldn't be too hard on Lloyd George either, because what we're essentially saying to them is that they were fools for not predicting Stalinism. Well, none of us can do that. People like Winston Churchill seem to be incredibly prescient when it comes to predicting the rise of Hitler, or observing that Soviet Union would be this immensely murderous regime. But he is somebody who said a lot about a lot, much of which was wrong, and he's also part of a class of conservatives with a small c, who thought Mussolini was rather great for much of his time in office. So the Wilson administration had hoped that there would be some kind of representation of the Russians at the Paris Peace Conference. People like Clemenceau believed that the Russians should receive no recognition, for they had signed the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk. The Russians had, under the Bolshevik government, had allowed the Germans to put hundreds of thousands of men into the West in order to launch the Ludendorff Spring Offensive. In fact, actually, it looks like now that that's not quite what happened. The men who fought in the Ludendorff Offensive were cherry-picked really from existing divisions in the West. There are fewer people moving east to west than perhaps we think. But that's by the by. What Clemenceau conveniently ignored was the fact that had it not been for the Russian offensives of 1914, the Germans would have been in Paris within 6 weeks. of the launching of the Schlieffen Plan. So the Russians did have, a very important part to play in the final victory, even if they had exited the war by that point. Lenin was not particularly interested in attending the Paris Peace Conference, and he was happy to publish the secret war plans hatched by Lord George and Clemenceau over the Middle East. The Tsar had been CC'd in on all of this and had been promised Constantinople and the Dardanelles. And there was a sense that Lenin was causing as much mischief as he could in order really to portray the Western powers as the imperialists he perceived them to be. By 1917, there's been this profound shift away from popular imperialism, in Britain, France, America, and other combatant powers. Is seen as really part of the black magic that has caused the war. So Lenin really does his best to cause a great deal of trouble for the Allies. Two members of Wilson's inner circle, William Bullitt, the diplomat, and Lincoln Steffens, the journalist who knew U.S. journalist who knew Russia very well, went to Moscow in order to see if U.S. Bolshevik relations could be established. Lincoln Steffens was, of course, famously one of the fellow traveller movement who was a great enthusiast for communism, never quite a member of the party himself, but was famous for saying, "I have seen the future and it works." He was able to kind of ignore the uglier side of communism, the violence and bloodshed that he saw in Russia, by saying that herein is a country going through a revolutionary transition. And here's where Wilson gained a lot of his insights into the condition of the new Soviet regime. He was given very sympathetic accounts by people like Steffens. And later on, interestingly, Roosevelt was similarly beguiled by Stalinism through the American fellow travellers who would return and visit the White House and tell him about the achievements of Stalinism and the hope that Stalinism was going through a radical, violent phase and would settle into something far more progressive eventually later on. One of the characters that Roosevelt deferred to was Anna Louise Strong, who had worked as a journalist in the Soviet Union and was enamoured with the place. She came from a devoutly Christian background, and she viewed the emergent society in the Soviet Union, even though it was secular, even though it persecuted the Orthodox Church, as some kind of development of God's work in the world. And she was so passionate about communism that she actually returned to America at the height of the five-year plans in order to interest American businessmen in investing in Russia. The Stalinist regime was quite interested in developing large American auto plants, particularly on the Volga River, and in return they were able to export gold. This gold is obviously all dug in places like Kolyma by Gulag slave labour. And Roosevelt quizzically asked Anna Louise Strong, where all Stalin's gold came from. And I'm not sure she gave him a particularly thorough answer to that one. It was one of the great ironies that in 1949 she's actually arrested by the Soviets as a spy. From the mid-1930s onwards, this kind of rather cozy toleration of Westerners coming to view the great experiment in the Soviet Union dissolves into a kind of into a Stalinist xenophobia and suspicion. And there are a great number of American fellow travellers and economic migrants to the USSR who vanish into the Soviet camp system. She manages to extricate herself from that, but during the McCarthyist period of the late 1940s, early 1950s, is viewed with immense suspicion back in the USA as well. Roosevelt and his view of Stalinism shows an interesting kind of continuity with the Wilsonian period. And obviously Roosevelt is the naval secretary and then vice presidential running mate under Wilson. I'm not suggesting for a moment that Roosevelt simply absorbed Wilson's ideas, but there is a certain kind of compatibility in that they looked upon the emergence of the Soviet Union as being something far more benign and or far more optimistic than that which actually emerges. And the reason for this, I guess, is that both men had this universalist, this American sort of universalism, where they were kind of hoping, Wilson at the end of the First World War is hoping that an American model of the future might emerge. You might have independent, free nation states liberated from imperialism, cooperating with one another, with constitutions, popular sovereignty, and free presses, civil rights, and free trade, free access to the seas. And from thence you create this 20th century, which is rather like a utopian 20th century. After the Second World War, and obviously, let us not forget, involving the League of Nations as the supranational body moderating all of this, the Roosevelt view of the world, whilst never quite articulated in something like the 14 points, Roosevelt never writes down the Roosevelt Doctrine. Instead, he has a hope after the Second World War, yes, there will be a United Nations, but there will also be, it's slightly less utopian, that there will be a series of spheres of influence between the great powers, which would, in Roosevelt's hope, be Russia, America, China, and the United Kingdom. Roosevelt certainly didn't want France involved in all of that. He was not a Francophile in any way, shape or form. Roosevelt, both Wilson and Roosevelt, hoped that the Soviet Union would emerge as a credible player and almost partner within this, within their respective new world systems that were going to emerge after these titanic conflicts. And unfortunately, in both instances, in the 1920s and 30s, the Soviet Union plays little part in regulating world affairs, and after 1945 it emerges as an antagonist to the United States. Both presidents, I think, are perhaps guilty of projecting rather naive notions onto the USSR, but let us not get into a kind of a sense of inevitability about what the USSR may or may not have become anyway. It's possible that the USSR may have had a moment where it could have emerged and evolved as a more liberal or more moderate regime. Quite possibly, the events of the Civil War and the perception of the Soviet Union being surrounded perpetually by enemies as a result of its revolutionary birth made the chances of a moderate and less paranoid regime very, very slim indeed. Anyway, I hope this has been useful, and if you are studying this at the moment and you want something a bit extra, you might find it useful to look at Chris Kostov's The Communist Century, which you can find on my website, www.explaininghistory.com, and I'll post a link to it at the end of this podcast. Anyway, thanks very much for listening, and I'll catch you on the next podcast. All the best. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.